16. The moment he pulled onto the base, Roberto knew that Abigail hadn't called Gordon Gray after all. If she had, they wouldn't have stopped him at the back gate on Andrews and sent him around to the main entrance on Pope. He wouldn't have had to wait 10 minutes for the two base security lunkheads to put him in a jeep and drive him to the runway, and Stratcom certainly would not have put him in the care of the 416th Fighter Squadron with a priority clearance and a passenger manifest that showed up on every screen in Omaha. Gordon would have moved with speed and with stealth. Roberto would have taken off 15 minutes ago on an already scheduled flight of the 916th Air Refueling Wing. Just another retired officer hitching a free ride west to see the kids. He would have been the kind of old duffer the pilots barely even notice, and certainly don't chart. Instead, he was alone in the back of a C-40A, as obvious and traceable as the Air Force could possibly make him. Darn it. It was such a good speech to Abigail, too. He'd really thought he'd put the fear of God into her. 6 or 7 minutes after takeoff, the phone rang in the burnished walnut cabinet next to his absurdly comfortable leather chair, and he picked it up. Hello? Designator, please? I had such high hopes for you, Abigail. Could you please tell me your designator? I guess I might have done the same thing at your age. All right, we can recover. Makes everything a little harder, but we'll fix it. She hung up. Of course, he'd known she'd hang up. She had to. He was just having a little fun with her. He had to admit, even though he was tired and even though the fate of everybody he could possibly think of was hanging in the balance, it was nice to feel useful again. Retirement had been a little disorienting so far. He'd looked forward to it for years, but he hadn't really prepared. He knew deep down that all the work on the house had been something of a dodge, and now even that was done. You can't just go from 40 years of movement and activity and forced but enjoyable camaraderie with an unbelievably varied cast of characters from all over the world to, well, sitting in a chair. Not overnight, and not without motion-induced nerve damage from the sudden stop, no matter how nice the chair is. He adored his wife. Any day spent in conversation with her was a good day by him. But a person's got his habits, and Roberto Diaz was used to being in motion. The phone rang again. He was still holding it, so he tapped the button with his thumb and answered midway through the first ring. He spared her the fucking around this time. 0474 Blue Indigo. Thank you. ¿Qué pasó, Abigail? I was very specific. Is there a problem with the transport? My screen has you over Fayetteville already. You didn't call Gordon Gray, he said. He was unavailable. Of course he's unavailable. It's 2 a.m. Everybody's unavailable until they aren't. You found me. I'm sure you could have. Mr. Gray passed away in January. His brain processed that statement in 3 distinct steps. The first 2 were achingly familiar, because they'd happened so often over the past 10 years. Step 1 was the absorption of the information. Gordon Gray was dead. The man who had once refused to cross a casino picket line out of moral principle was gone. Gordon, Roberto had said at the time, you're drunk as a skunk, you're gambling with your rent money, you just broke a guy's nose because he stepped on your foot, and you're in Las Vegas. Why exactly are you making a stand here? Gordon had just smiled at him and shrugged. I'm full of contradictions. There were 1,000 other memories, most of them far less benign, but that was how he always chose to remember Gordon, as a pretty amusing bundle of non-matching character traits. Now that particular molecular combination of soul and folly no longer existed. Once Roberto forgot about that endearing moment in Las Vegas, it would be gone into the ether. It would never have occurred. That was step 1, the sudden and vertiginous emptiness of death. Step 2 came close on the heels of that feeling, and it was compassion. He was sad about the hole that Gordon's death must have left behind with his family, his friends, his brothers and sisters in arms. Roberto now had some people to belatedly console, a few phone calls to make. And that was what brought on step 3, which was an entirely new thought, one he hadn't had with any friend's death till this moment. Roberto had the grim feeling that he'd just moved into a new phase of proximity to death, because no one had called him to say, "Gordon's dead." When you're young, the reaction is, "Holy shit, so-and-so is dead, can you believe it?" Then you get older and start glancing at the obituaries to see if there's anybody you know in there. But that stage doesn't come as a surprise because every middle-aged person you've ever met tells you they do that. Then, when you're older still, starts the sad litany of phone calls coming in as nature's sniper starts picking off your friends and family one by one. You buy a funeral suit, and then a couple of different ties for it so you don't have to wear the same thing every time. You get used to all that. But this thing, this was brand new. At 68, Roberto had reached the age where somebody died and nobody called. Not because they didn't care, but because it's too fucking depressing. That was a new one. He didn't say any of this to Abigail. To her, he said, "I see." "In January," she repeated. "Who did you call instead?" A man's voice answered for her. "Thank you, Belvoir. You can clear the line." Roberto kicked himself for imagining they'd been alone on the line. Only a few years out and his edges had been dulled already. There was a faint click as Abigail disconnected, and Roberto could hear the colonel breathing on the other end. "Hello, Roberto." "Hey, Jarabek. How's that rash?" "Your wife said put some cream on it. It's fine now." Why did men talk like this to each other? Why not just agree to meet up and punch each other in the face until they felt better about things? Jarabek went on, enjoying the role reversal. When Roberto had retired, the colonel had moved up, and that was the spot from which he looked down at this time. "I thought you put this one to bed 30 years ago." "Apparently it woke up," Roberto said. "Sounds like a broken thermistor to me." "That would be nice to think." "I'll be frank with you, Roberto. You're on that airplane as a gesture of respect to Gordon Gray. No other reason." Again, why the fuck had no one called to tell him Gordon was dead? People sucked. "Threat assessment and sober report. That's what I want, and that's all I want. Clear?" "Gotcha," Roberto said. "Hey, you got a cell number for Leffler?" "See, you're saying that to irritate me, Roberto, and I understand. I would do the same thing. This is the sort of jocular back and forth I so enjoy with you. But I'm not kidding around. This is going to go quietly and quickly. Assess and report, no off-the-book stuff." "Phil, I'm fucking with you. It's probably nothing. I'll check it out and go home. And by the way, you're welcome. I'm not exactly on the clock anymore." Jarabek took a moment, deciding whether or not to trust him, and opted for some of both. "I know that. Thank you for making yourself available." "You should probably take me off the file." "I will do that. Keep in touch." The phone went dead. Roberto held it for a moment, thinking. He looked out the window at the lights of Charlotte down below off to his right. Broken thermistor, my ass. Fuck that guy. Off the books was exactly where he was going. He'd be on the ground in Kansas in less than 2 hours. That would make it tight. But if Trini answered, he had an outside shot at it. The trick would be coding the call, and he certainly couldn't do it on the plane's phone. He reached into his flight bag, took out the MacBook Air his son Alexander had given him for Christmas. "Too much. Makes everybody uncomfortable. Tone it down, Alexander." And turned it on. The plane's Wi-Fi signal was half-decent, and he called up Tortu Web without hitting a DOD net nanny. First stroke of luck. John Dunim and the other two or three other Dot Onion rerouters he knew were already dead. The dark net had pretty fast-moving currents, and he wasn't surprised to see he was already out of date. He was trying to think of next steps when something in his jacket pocket buzzed. It was the satellite phone, the one he'd taken out of the safe back in his kitchen. He looked at the screen, didn't recognize a number. He made an educated guess. "Abigail, I can talk for 2 minutes." It was her. Roberto was genuinely delighted. "I think you have the wrong number," he replied, and hung up the satellite phone, which was most certainly monitored. He tapped a few keys on the laptop, accessed a deep beep site he trusted, thank God that one was still there, and leached into the first number with at least 10 nodes of encryption that scrolled by. He called her back and she picked up on the first ring. "I'm on my personal cell in the ladies' room." He could hear the echo of her voice off the tile. "I take it you read my white paper."
"I did," she said.
"And you believed it. What do you need me to—" She stopped, and he could hear that the door to the bathroom had just opened. Someone had come in. Roberto took over. "Okay, I'll talk, you listen. Even with encryption, airplane Wi-Fi won't be secure enough for the conversations I need to have, so you'll need to make the calls for me. Find a reason to get yourself out of there on the double. Go buy a burner and call a former agent named Trini Romano. I'll repeat that name before I hang up. When she answers, tell her Margot is under the weather."
"Margot is under the weather? I'm sorry to hear that."
Still with a stilted voice. She wasn't alone in the bathroom. "That's it. Then tell her what you know. She'll help you with the list. Even number 7. Especially number 7. We're under 2 hours, so you have to move fast." In the background, he heard a toilet flush. He continued, "Text your burner number to me through a mix master, and I'll call you when I'm rolling." Water ran in the bathroom. Someone was washing her hands. Abigail sighed.
"I understand, Mom. I just think it's kind of soon after your knee replacement."
Roberto smiled. She was pretty good, all things considered. "I'm dying to know why you decided to believe me, but that can wait. Doesn't matter, I guess." He could hear the bathroom door open and close again. Abigail's tone changed.
"Is it as bad as what you wrote in the report?"
"Every bit. And none of the people who understand that are in power anymore. Jerebeg is not going to bed, he'll keep an eye on things, and he will not be helpful. But believe it or not, I've done all this before."
"Including item 7?
He didn't answer that. "Trini Romano." He hung up.